Like the Salomon preferred stock, the terms of these special deals meant that critics suddenly viewed Buffett as protecting the interests of entrenched CEOs. It was, of course, in the interest of his own shareholders to maximize their returns while protecting them from risk, but Buffett now looked like one of those boardroom insiders who depended on special deals to get ahead. In the age of the buyout funds and corporate raiders, this level of greed was chump change. Buffett could have easily been a buyout king himself. But what his determination to stay friendly and on the side of management did make clear was that he was now one of the guys at the country club. Ben Graham had always felt that if someone traded in stocks, this necessarily made him an outsider, because he had to be willing to displease a company's management. Buffett, who wanted to be liked by everyone, had been trying to bridge that gap since his earliest investing days when he became friends with Lorimer Davidson at Geico. Now, many Wall Street investors say Mr. Buffett's special deals amount to a kind of gentlemanly protection game, said one news story. In the end, what looked like sweetheart deals turned out to be no more than finely handicapped bets. Only Gillette turned into a winner, ultimately earning Berkshire $5.5 billion. U.S. Air was the worst. Buffett had made a number of remarks over the years about the stupidity of investing in things with wings. Then the company suspended its dividend and, like Cleveland's worst mill, the stock plunged. That was the dumbest fucking thing going into that deal, one friend exploded. What the hell are you guys doing? You violated every one of your principles. Buffett would later agree, saying, as soon as the check cleared, the company went into the red and never came out. I have an 800 number I call and say, my name's Warren Buffett, and I'm an heiraholic. Charlie Munger's dry comment was, Warren didn't call me on that one. Salomon, the model for these deals, was also not doing well. After the crash and the near escape from Pearlman, the merger business had been slow to get back on its feet, and talented bankers left for elsewhere. Gutfreund had restructured the firm once again in another round of layoffs, but the managing directors no longer feared him. People kept threatening John, and he would try to buy them, said one vice chairman. At first, the firm had 3, then 7 vice chairmen. Honk if you're a vice chairman, became a joke around the room. Already fragmented into disparate power bases, Salomon now evolved into a system of warlords. A corporate bond warlord, a government bond warlord, a mortgage bond warlord, an equities warlord. One ruled above them all, the warlord of bond arbitrage, a soft-spoken, brilliant mathematician, the 40-year-old John Merriweather. The shy, self-effacing J.M., a former Ph.D. candidate, expressed his outsize ambitions through a team of professors he had lured with Wall Street salaries from schools like Harvard and MIT. These ARB boys hunched protectively over their computers, fiddling with mathematical models portraying the bond universe, an oasis of intellect amid the belching, sweating traders who more often swung from their gut. Like handicappers assembling the financial version of the daily racing form, the ARBs were launching a revolution in the bond business, and the edge their computer tip sheet gave them against the rest of the suckers produced most of Salomon's profits. They lived inside Merriweather's little bubble on the trading floor and felt they had earned their arrogance. J.M. was enormously forgiving of mistakes, but relentless toward anyone he considered stupid, and the ARBs were his personally chosen elite. He had a deeply complex personal relationship with his team and spent nearly all his time with them, engaging in one of his 3 obsessions, work, gambling, and golf. Many an evening after the markets closed, the ARBs sat together playing liar's poker to hone their handicapping skills. The boyish-looking, blank-faced Merriweather usually won. Despite his passivity and limited influence as a board member, Buffett certainly understood arbitrage. But the board's knowledge of Salomon's business details went only so far, and Buffett did not understand computers, which were becoming important to every business and intrinsic to the new Wall Street. He did know, however, that he was now a director of a corporation that was utterly dependent on computers, and he had certainly figured out that computers increased risk. He once visited Mark Byrne, the son of Jack Byrne, who traded foreign exchange options for Salomon. Mark was bright and young, and he had a computer in his home so he could trade all the time. He had rigged it so that if the Japanese yen moved more than a certain amount, it rang a bell or something and woke him up in the middle of the night. I said to Mark, "Now let me get this straight. You've got this computer here, and at 3 in the morning, after you've been doing who knows what, we won't even ask, until 1 or 2 in the morning, you're asleep, and this bell rings, and you get up and stagger over to the computer, and you see that the yen-dollar relationship is such and such. Tell me, is there any limit to what you can punch into the computer in terms of the size of the trade that you'd do? Does the computer rebel if you make a mistake?" And he said, "No, I can type whatever I want." So I said, "Well, if you've had a little too much to drink and you punch 3 extra zeros in there by mistake, is the firm committed? Does it have to follow through with the trade?" And he said, "Yeah." So I had these nightmares of this guy at 3 in the morning, maybe with a girl still in the bed or something, going over there in a daze and sort of punching something into the computer in the middle of the night and then staggering back to bed, and finding out the next morning that instead of a trillion yen, he'd put in a quadrillion yen. To Buffett, it was obvious that the combination of fallible human beings and judgment-free computers in a completely unmonitored, unsupervised environment meant an almost unlimited potential for things to go wildly out of control. But as a board member, he lacked authority to make changes and could only try persuasion. By now, he and Munger had wrangled repeatedly and unsuccessfully with Solomon's management. Munger had taken over the audit committee, which had not formerly been a bastion of zealous oversight, and put it through 6- and 7-hour dissections of the firm and its accountants. Munger discovered that Solomon's derivatives business had grown immensely, using trades for which no ready market existed. The trades would not settle for long periods, sometimes years. With minimal cash changing hands, the derivatives were valued on Solomon's books using a model. Since the model was created by those whose bonuses it would determine, not surprisingly, the models usually showed the trades were quite profitable. As much as $20 million of profits had been overstated through such accounting mismarks. The audit committee, however, addressed only trades and deals already approved and usually completed. The real oversight took place before the fact. There, in the one area in which Buffett and Munger unequivocally had more skill than anyone else, making investments, they weighed in loudest of all and were ignored. Their protestations only alienated them from the employees. In one example, Solomon's Fibro unit had formed a joint venture with a 7-year-old Houston company, Anglo-Swiss, to build oil fields in West Siberia, south of the Arctic Circle, that would supposedly revolutionize oil production in Russia. The White Knights venture brought peace offerings to Russia, among them a recreation center, food and clothing, all flown over from the United States. "Anglo-Swiss," Munger said when the idea was floated, "this is an idiotic idea. There are no Anglos and no Swiss involved in this company. The name alone is reason not to get involved." But Solomon put $116 million into the joint venture anyway, thinking that oil was going to be integral to Russia's future and that Western capital was needed to extract the oil. But while "the country isn't going to go away," as Buffett said, "and the oil isn't going to go away," the Russian political system could go away. No margin of safety could cover that. Sure enough, as soon as the White Knights joint venture got going, the Russian government began toying with a tax on oil exports. The tax nearly wiped out White Knights' profit. Then the volume of oil production proved disappointing. Russian nabobs flew to the United States and expected to be entertained with prostitutes. The Russian government was unpredictable and uncooperative, resulting in setbacks from start to finish. Somebody was going to make a lot of money from oil in Russia, but it wasn't going to be Solomon Incorporated. Russia, however, was merely a sideshow at the time. In 1989, the United States had become obsessed with the possibility that the whole country would be eclipsed by the rising sun of Japan. Solomon had invested large sums in Japan and was doing well in its startup business there, which had grown rapidly to hundreds of employees and was making money under its head, Derek Maughan, who had wisely given local talent the reins. Buffett, who generally did not buy foreign stocks, and who believed Japanese stocks in particular to be outrageously expensive, had shown little interest in anything related to Japan. Catherine Graham, however, had developed a fascination with Akio Morita, one of the world's most brilliant businessmen. Morita was chairman of Sony, one of the world's most successful corporations. Graham brought the two men together at one of her dinners, but they did not click. Finally, during one of Buffett's trips to New York, Morita-san held a small dinner for Graham, Buffett, and May Greenfield at his Fifth Avenue apartment overlooking the Metropolitan Museum. Buffett, who seemed slightly mystified by Graham's interest in this powerful visionary man, observing grudgingly that Graham was sort of enchanted by Morita, agreed to go. Buffett had never eaten Japanese food, but knew it might be problematic. He went to plenty of events where he touched nothing more than the dinner rolls. He could easily go 7 or 8 hours at a time without eating. He disliked offending his hosts, however, and as his reputation had grown, he found that there was no way to fake eating by cutting things up and moving them around. People noticed. One side of the Morita's apartment had a sweeping view of Central Park, the other a sweeping view of the sushi kitchen. A highlight for guests was the opportunity to watch the four chefs prepare the elaborate meal behind a glass window. As they were seated for dinner, Buffett looked at the chefs. What was this going to be like? He wondered. As guest of honor, he was seated facing the kitchen. There were chopsticks on a little stand and tiny cruets and miniature bowls of soy sauce. He already knew he didn't like soy sauce. The first course was brought out. Everyone slurped it down. Buffett mumbled an excuse. He motioned for his full plate to be taken away. The next course arrived. Buffett could not identify it, but looked at it with dread. He saw that May Greenfield, who had eating habits similar to his, also was having difficulties. Mrs. Morita, seated next to him, smiled politely and barely spoke. Buffett gurgled another excuse. He nodded again for the waiter to remove his plate. As his untouched dishes returned to the kitchen, he was sure the chefs noticed. The waiter brought out another unidentifiable course of something that looked rubbery and raw to him. Kay and the Moritas tucked in with enthusiasm. Mrs. Morita smiled politely once again when he offered a third excuse. Buffett squirmed. He liked his steaks bloody, but did not eat raw fish. The waiter cleared the plates. The chefs kept their heads down. Buffett was sweating. He was running out of excuses. The chefs looked busy, but he was sure they must be peeking sideways from behind the glass to see what he would do. Course after course arrived, and each of his plates went back, untouched. He imagined that he heard a slight buzz from the kitchen. How many more courses could there possibly be? He had not realized there were this many things on the planet that could be eaten raw. Mrs. Morita seemed slightly embarrassed for him, but he wasn't sure, because she smiled politely all the time and said so little. Time crawled more slowly with each course. He had been counting, and the number of courses now exceeded 10. He tried to make up for his culinary lapses with witty, self-deprecating conversation about business with Morita-san, but he knew he was disgracing himself. Even in the middle of his bonfire of embarrassment, he could not help but think longingly of hamburgers. He was sure that the beehive in the kitchen was humming louder with every plate he sent back. By the end of 15 courses, he had still not eaten a bite. The Moritas could not have been more polite, which added to his humiliation. He was desperate to escape back to Kay's apartment, where popcorn and peanuts and strawberry ice cream awaited him. "It was the worst," he says about the meal he did not eat. "I've had others like that, but it was by far the worst. I will never eat Japanese food again." Meanwhile, hundreds of Salomon employees who would have crawled up Fifth Avenue on their knees blindfolded to eat this same dinner with the Moritas were instead dining at high-priced Japanese restaurants and mutinying over the size of their huge bonus checks. The hugeness of their checks was not the point. It was the hugeness of their checks compared with others' huge checks that mattered. Buffett and Munger knew little of the trouble fomenting at Salomon. Meriwether's Arbs had been agitating for more money. The former college professors, hired away from salaries of $29,000, felt they were subsidizing money-losing departments like equity investment banking. They viewed sharing their profits as socialist. The ARBs could have made more on their own. They wanted a cut of the hundreds of millions they earned for the firm. Although he was so shy that he had trouble maintaining eye contact, Meriwether now became the world's most aggressive and successful bonus pimp. Gutfreund caved and gave the ARBs 15% of what they made, which meant they had the potential to come away with much more money than the traders who shared their bonus pool. The deal was made in secret between Gutfreund and Salomon's president, Tom Strauss. The board never knew, nor did other employees at Salomon. Yet. By 1991, Buffett and Munger had been through a series of disappointments and setbacks at Salomon. The financial results they got were not always up to date. Staff demands for bonuses continued to spiral. They disagreed with much of what went on in the boardroom. The stock price had not moved for 8 years. Earnings were down $167 million, mostly because of employees' pay. Buffett, having so far let Munger be the appointed bad guy, now roused himself, met with the executive committee, and told them to cut back. Yet when the final bonus pool number came through, it was $7 million higher than before. Under the new formula that Meriwether, as bonus pimp, had procured for his ARB boys, one of them, Larry Hillebrand, got a raise from $3 to $23 million. When word of Hillebrand's bonus leaked to the press, some of his colleagues went crazy with envy and felt cheated, the millions they were making forgotten. Buffett himself had no problem with the ARB's bonuses. "I believe in paying talent," he says, "but not, as Charlie would say, as a royalty on time." The arrangement was like a hedge fund's fee structure and bore some resemblance to his old partnership. It would put more pressure on the rest of the firm to perform. What he objected to was not being told. He objected even more to the fact that other people did not get haircuts for their lack of performance. Gutfreund had shown a better sense of proportion than most of his traders, opting to take a 35% pay cut, in line with the decline in earnings. This helped him with Buffett, who thought Gutfreund had more class than his employees. But Buffett's sense of decency was so offended by the employees' greed that he overcame his natural inertia and voted against the bonuses for the traders. He was overruled. When word of Buffett's no vote raced through the hallways of Salomon, people were outraged. A billionaire who loved money had called them greedy. Buffett considered Salomon a casino with a restaurant out front. The restaurant was a loss leader. The traders, especially Meriwether's people, were the casino, the purity of risk-taking done without conflicts of interest. That was the part of the business Buffett liked, and the new pay system was designed to keep the ARBs from bolting. But by trying to operate the firm under two distinct pay systems, as if it really were a casino with a restaurant out front, Gutfreund had driven a rift through Solomon's heart. Now Meriwether and Hillebrand asked Gutfreund for permission to approach Buffett to buy back his convertible preferred stock. The terms were so rich that it was costing Solomon too much. They were no longer under threat of a takeover. Why pay for Buffett's protection? Gutfreund said they could talk to Buffett and try to convince him he was better off without the preferred stock. When approached, Buffett said that he was amenable. But having Buffett as an investor must have made Gutfreund feel more secure, for in the end he got cold feet. Thus, Buffett was held to his original deal. Having invested both Berkshire's $700 million and his own reputation in John Gutfreund, by 1991, it was too late to back out. Chapter 48. Thumbsucking and its hollow-cheeked result. New York City, 1991. On Thursday afternoon, August 8, 1991, Buffett was driving to Reno, Nevada from Lake Tahoe on his annual weekend with Astrid and the Blumkin boys. He always looked forward to this trip and was in a relaxed and jovial mood. John Gutfreund's office had called him that morning. "Where will you be tonight between 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and midnight?" they asked. "We want to talk to you." Thinking this was really unusual, he said he was going to a show. They told him to call Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen and Katz, the law firm that represented Solomon, at 7:30 p.m. Hmm, he thought, maybe they're going to sell the firm. It sounded like good news to him. The stock was trading around $37, close to $38, the price at which his preferred stock would convert to common, and he would take his profits and be done with Solomon. Gutfreund, who had a long-standing habit of calling him for advice, might need help in negotiating terms. Buffett and company whiled away the afternoon in Reno. Buffett reminisced, in 1980 he had been offered the entire contents of a Reno landmark, the Hera collection from the National Automobile Museum, 1,400 cars covering acres and acres, a 1932 Rolls-Royce Salamanca, a 1922 Mercedes Targa Floria Racer, a 1932 Bugatti Coupe, a 1955 Ferrari, a 1913 Pierce Arrow. It would have cost him less than $1 million for the whole collection. He had wavered, then passed. A few years later, part of the collection, hundreds of cars, had been gradually auctioned for a total of $69 million. One car, the Bugatti Royale, had recently been sold to a Houston real estate developer for $6.5 million. By 7:30 p.m., they had returned to Lake Tahoe. We got to the hotel, and the rest of them went into the dining room of the steakhouse. I told them, this may take a while. I found a payphone outside on the wall and dialed into the number they gave me. Buffett expected to be connected with Gutfreund, but Gutfreund was on a plane from London, where he had been trying to save the firm's mandate in an investment banking deal for British Telecom. His flight had been delayed, and Buffett sat on hold for quite a while as a conversation took place on the other end about whether to wait for him to arrive before continuing. Finally, Tom Strauss and Don Feuerstein got on the phone to tell Buffett what was going on, or a version of it, anyway. Tom Strauss, 49 years old, was there to protect Gutfreund's flank. He had been appointed Solomon's president 5 years earlier, during the Great Purge of 1987. Responsible for the firm's international business, he was also charged with the Sisyphean task of licking the perennially lagging equity division into shape. As recent history showed, however, management was not a skill cultivated at Solomon. The warlords reported straight to Gutfreund, to the extent that they reported to anyone at all. Their clout came from their group's production of revenues. Strauss might be technically president of Solomon, but he had been promoted so high that he now floated distantly above the trading floor like a helium balloon. Periodically, the warlords batted him out of the way. Don Feuerstein, the head of Solomon's legal department, had once played an important role at the SEC and was regarded as an excellent technical lawyer. He was Gutfreund's consigliere, nicknamed POD, the Prince of Darkness, for the behind-the-scenes dirty work he did. Solomon's warlords, accustomed to doing whatever the hell they wanted, worked through lawyers who reported to Feuerstein, including Zachary Snow, the assistant general counsel assigned to the trading operations. The warlord structure made the legal department both powerful and weak. It stewarded the firm's franchise in much the way that everything happened at Solomon, by catering to factions and reacting to events. Solomon's trading culture had embedded itself so strongly that even Feuerstein was a trader, lovingly operating a wine syndicate on behalf of several managing directors. His fax machine constantly spewed forth notices of wine auctions that were a profitable sideline for the syndicate's participants, its product more traded and collected than drunk. This evening, no one was toasting anything, however. Feuerstein knew that Buffett and Gutfreund were friends. He felt awkward giving sensitive information to Buffett when Gutfreund should have been in on the call. Using a set of talking papers, he and Strauss told Buffett that a problem had arisen. A Wachtell-Lipton investigation had uncovered the fact that Paul Moser, who ran Solomon's government bond department, had broken the Treasury Department's auction bidding rules several times in 1990 and 1991. Moser and his deputy, who was complicit, were now suspended, and the firm was notifying the regulators. Who the hell is Paul Moser? Buffett wondered. Paul Moser, 36 years old, had been swooped up by New York from selling bonds in the Chicago office. He was as intense as a laser beam and started his day before the sun came up, parked in front of a trading screen in his bedroom, taking a call from London, then galloped a couple of blocks from his tiny apartment in Battery Park City over to Solomon's enormous new trading room, housed in the gleaming pink granite space of 7 World Trade Center. There, he stared at another set of screens until past sunset and oversaw 20 traders, most of whom towered over his short, wiry frame. Moser was smart and hyper-aggressive, but he also struck people as frustrated and insecure, an odd duck. Although he'd grown up on Long Island, he seemed like a greenhorn from the Midwest among the slick New Yorkers. He had been one of Meriwether's arbitrage boys until Craig Coates, the head of the government desk, resigned and he was asked to take over. Now he still worked for Meriwether, but was on the outside looking in at his former gang. Gutfreund, who was under pressure from Buffett and the board to improve the numbers, had added the Foreign Exchange Department to Moser's duties. In a few months, he had turned a black hole around and made it profitable. So Gutfreund had reason to be grateful to Moser. While Moser could be abrasive and condescending, as though he considered other people morons compared to himself, those who worked closely with him were fond of him. Unlike people on Solomon's infamous mortgage desk, he did not abuse trainees by hurling food at them or sending them racing out the door to buy 12 pizzas at a time. Sometimes he even talked to the trainees. For his labors, Moser had been paid $4.75 million that year. It was a lot of money, but it was not enough. Moser was World Cup competitive, and Moser was pissed. Something had snapped in him when he found out that his former colleague, Larry Hillebrand, had gotten $23 million from a secret pay deal. He used to earn more than the ARB boys, and now he went apeshit. He copped such an attitude that he demanded that his department not be audited, as if somehow oversight did not apply to him. Moser was one of a few dozen men who communed regularly with the U.S. government on its financing needs, talking to the Federal Reserve staff nearly every day and dining quarterly with the Treasury Department bureaucrats at the Madison Hotel. Representing Solomon as a primary dealer, he offered the government market chatter and advice and, in turn, stood first in line as its largest customer whenever the government wanted to sell debt, like a member of the College of Cardinals who sat at the right hand of the Pope. Only the primary dealers could buy bonds from the government. Everyone else had to do it by submitting bids through the primary dealers, who acted as brokers. This gave the dealers the clout that goes with access and enormous market share. Knowing the needs of both their clients and the government, the dealers clipped off a profit from the gap that lay between the supply and the demand. But with that position of power went a commensurate dose of trust. The government expected primary dealers to behave like cardinals who were celebrating mass. Yes, they drank first from the communion cup, but they must not get loaded and embarrass the church. As an auction neared, the primary dealers would work the phones, polling customers to gauge their appetite for bonds. Moser's sense of how hot the market was running translated into Solomon's bid. A few seconds before the clock struck 1 p.m. on the appointed day, the dealers phoned runners, who stood by a wall of phones at the Federal Reserve Building downtown, waiting to scribble down orders by hand and dash to the Fed clerk's wooden box where they jammed them inside. At the stroke of 1 p.m., the clerk placed his hand over the slot. That ended the auction. The government had used this antiquated system for decades. The inherent tension of the market lay in the opposing interests of the Treasury and the dealers regarding pricing and amounts. The Treasury auctioned only a certain amount of bonds and wanted the highest price, while the dealers wanted to pay just enough in the auction to win a larger share than anyone else, yet no more than necessary, for that would hurt their profit on resale. So finely calibrated were these bids that the traders used increments of 1/1,000th of a dollar. That sounds like almost nothing, but clipping off 1/1,000th of enough dollars amounted to a fortune. On $100 million, it was worth $100,000. On $1 billion, it was worth $1 million. Because government bonds were less profitable than mortgages and corporate bonds, treasury bonds had to be traded in blocks this size in order for the dealers and money managers to make enough money for it to be worth their while. Dovetailing with the need for such large trades was the government's need to work with large dealers, those who knew the market well and had the power to distribute a lot of bonds. Solomon was the largest dealer by far. In the early 1980s, the Treasury had allowed any individual firm to buy up to half of a given bond issue for its own account. Solomon commonly cooped an auction this way, then held on to the bonds long enough to squeeze anybody who was short treasuries, having bet the prices would fall, because there were no bonds available for short sellers to buy to cover their positions. Prices shot up, the short sellers screamed, the trading floor erupted in cheers, and Solomon gloated over its huge profits and swung a big stick as the king of Wall Street. Cooping the auctions fattened the usually thin profits on government bonds and sent a heady mist of testosterone drifting above the formerly stodgy section where the humdrum government bond traders sat at their desks. In response to grumbling, the Treasury lowered the limit and said no individual dealer could buy more than 35%. Which made it harder to coop the auction. Smaller squeezes still occurred, but Solomon no longer owned the market unchallenged. Naturally, the new rule was unpopular at Solomon. Since the total of bids exceeded all the bonds on offer, the Treasury also prorated everyone, which meant a firm that wanted 35% had to bid more than 35%, a juggling act. Thus, in various ways, the clampdown made it harder to profit at the government desk at Solomon. The mist of testosterone did not dissipate, however. Moser tested the Treasury's patience twice in 1990, bidding more than 100% of all the bonds to be issued. Michael Basham, who ran the auctions, told him not to do it again. Moser was sent to an apology breakfast with Bob Glauber, an undersecretary of the Treasury. He squeaked out some words, but did not exactly apologize. He claimed that overbidding was in the government's best interest because it increased demand for bonds. Not mollified, Basham changed the rules so that no individual firm could even bid more than 35% for its own account. The limit on bids meant Solomon might not even get its full 35% limit of bonds. Now Feuerstein read Buffett a copy of a Solomon press release to be issued the next morning, which was being explained to all board members that night. It described how Moser had responded to this stare-down with Basham. He had proceeded to submit unauthorized bids in excess of the government's bidding limit in the December 1990 and February 1991 auctions. Feuerstein gave Buffett a scripted version of events and told him that he had already spoken at length with Munger, who was at his cabin in Minnesota. Munger said something to him about thumbsucking and added, "People do that all the time." Buffett recognized the term thumbsucking as a Mungerism for procrastination, but wasn't really concerned. Feuerstein did not mention anything else discussed in the lengthy conversation with Munger, and Buffett did not ponder whose thumb was being sucked. 7 or 8 minutes later, he got off the phone, recognizing that this wasn't the good news for which he had been hoping, but not feeling alarmed enough to call Munger immediately. He'd check in with Munger over the weekend, he decided, but for now, he was going to enjoy Lake Tahoe. Then he wandered back to join Astrid and the Blumpkins in the dining room, where they were having a steak before seeing Joan Rivers and Neil Sedaka perform. While Buffett was watching the show, John Gutfrund's plane from London finally landed. Gutfrund, Strauss, and Feuerstein had a conversation late that evening with Richard Breeden and Bill McLucas, top officials at the SEC. The three of them also placed a call to Gerald Corrigan, the beefy 6'4" president of the New York branch of the Federal Reserve. Using a different set of talking papers, Gutfrund and Strauss told Breeden, McLucas, and Corrigan more of the story than Solomon's board had just heard. Moser had not just overbid. To get around the 35% limit, at the February 1991 Treasury auction, he had entered a fake bid in the name of a customer and stashed the bonds he got in Solomon's account. In fact, he had placed more than one false bid in that auction. As to why these had not been reported earlier, they explained the delay as an oversight. Yet the SEC and the Treasury were in the midst of investigating Moser, for he had pulled a huge squeeze in the May 2-year note auction. His actions were under intense scrutiny by regulators. That should have been true at Salomon as well. How could the delay have been an oversight? Now the regulators had to consider whether this confession indicated some major systemic problem at Salomon. No matter what, these admissions were going to be highly embarrassing to the Treasury and the Federal Reserve. Corrigan was shocked that the firm had not come to him saying that it had already fired Moser and created a remedial program that involved instituting all sorts of new controls. But he expected something like that to be announced within 24 or 48 hours, after which he could keep them on probation for a while and hope that would be the end of it. He told Gutfreund and Strauss, patiently and dispassionately, as he recalls, that they had an immediate obligation to release this information to the public. Based on what he knew, he surmised that the incident could blow up into a very, very, very significant problem. It seemed to him, however, that Strauss and Gutfreund did not fully grasp this. Indeed, with hindsight, the fact that Gutfreund had gone off to London, thus placing his ability to participate in the calls with Buffett, Munger, and the other directors in the hands of an airline, was itself a telling sign. The next day, Friday, August 9th, Buffett was enjoying himself with Astrid and the Blumpkins, walking along the bored sidewalks of Virginia City, the old Western gold rush town. He called into his office. Nothing urgent was happening. Nobody at Salomon had called him. Salomon had put out the press release describing the events in fairly bland terms. The stock had fallen 5%, however, to $34.75. Buffett called Munger on Saturday at his cabin on Star Island in Minnesota. Munger flatly told him a much more detailed and alarming story. Forstein, reciting from the list of talking points, had said that one part of the problem has been known since last April. While these same words had been read to the other directors, including Buffett, they had the effect of technically informing without really enlightening. But Munger picked up instantly on bullshit legalese and the passive voice, which irritated him. What did that mean, has been known? What exactly had been known, and by whom? When pressed, Forstein gave Munger a much fuller description of events, similar to what Corrigan had been told. As Forstein recounted, Moser had gotten a letter from the Treasury Department in April saying they were investigating one of his bids. Realizing that the game was up, on April 25th he had gone to his boss, John Merriweather, and made a confession of sorts. In February, to get around the 35% limit, he had not only bid in Solomon's name, he had also submitted phony bids under real customers' names. Moser swore to Merriweather that this was the only time and he would never do it again. Merriweather had recognized immediately that this was career-threatening, had said so to Moser, and had reported the situation to Forstein and Strauss. On April 29th, the three of them went to Gutfreund and told him what Moser had confessed. Gutfreund, they said later, had been red-faced and pissed off when he heard the news. Therefore, in April, Gutfreund knew. Strauss knew. Merriweather knew. Forstein, the general counsel, knew. They all knew. Forstein had informed Gutfreund at the time that Moser's actions appeared criminal. He didn't believe that the firm technically had a legal reporting requirement. Still, Forstein was sure that Salomon would run seriously afoul of the regulators if it didn't do something, and therefore the Federal Reserve must be told. Gutfreund said it would be taken care of. Curiously, however, no specific plans were made to march down to the Federal Reserve's ornate Italianate building and give Jerry Corrigan the news. Moreover, having concluded that the phony bid was a one-time aberrant act, they had decided to leave Moser in charge of the government desk. Hearing this, "Well, that's just thumb-sucking," Munger had said. "People do that all the time." He later explained that by thumb-sucking he meant sitting there thinking and dawdling, musing and consulting, when you should be acting. Munger told Buffett that he had challenged the press release. Shouldn't management's prior knowledge be disclosed? Forstein said that yes, it should be, But the decision had been made not to because Solomon's management thought that disclosure would threaten the company's funding. Solomon had tens of billions of short-term commercial paper debt that rolled over day by day. If the word got out, lenders would refuse to renew. To Munger, funding difficulties was shorthand for financial panic. Lacking the leverage to insist, he had given in. But he and Buffett now agreed that more disclosure was required. They mentally braced themselves for what would follow. 2 days later, on Monday morning, August 12th, the Wall Street Journal reported the alleged details with a blaring headline, "The Big Squeeze, Solomon's Admission of T-Note Infractions Gives Market a Jolt. Firm share of one auction may have reached 85%. Investigations underway. How much did bosses know?" It mentioned the possibility of civil charges of market manipulation, violations of the anti-fraud provisions of securities law, misrepresentations to federal authorities, books and records violations, and criminal charges for committing both wire and mail fraud. Gutfreund called Buffett, sounding calm. Buffett thought that he seemed to believe the whole situation meant a few points on the stock. In light of the disastrous article, Buffett thought this attitude was unrealistic, a sign that Gutfreund believed the whole affair could somehow be finessed. It seemed of a piece with Gutfreund's unwarranted composure the previous week. Buffett pressed for more disclosure. Solomon's Treasury Division was beginning to have trouble rolling over its commercial paper, meaning the firm's lenders were starting to show signs of nervousness. Meanwhile, Munger was trying to get in touch with Wachtell Lipton's Marty Lipton, who was John Gutfreund's indispensable best friend as well as Solomon's outside counsel. So entwined with Solomon was Lipton that the speed dial buttons on Donald Feuerstein's phone rang his wife, the Sotheby's and Christie's auction houses, and Marty Lipton, not necessarily in that order. Munger knew that Lipton and his telephone were as inseparable as Buffett and his Wall Street Journal. Cell phones still being so rare, however, that even name partners of major law firms did not use them, Munger relied on Wachtell Lipton's office, which, he would later observe to the SEC, had the finest phone system for reaching Marty Lipton at any hour of the day or night that I have ever seen in the history of the world. I think even if he was engaged in sexual intercourse, you could get through to him. Whether Lipton was horizontal when reached by Munger was never specified, but Munger badgered him for a follow-up press release, saying the first had been inadequate. Lipton agreed that the board would hold a telephone meeting to discuss it on Wednesday. Not surprisingly, Jerry Corrigan at the Federal Reserve was even less satisfied than Munger with Solomon's muted response. On Monday, August 12th, he decided to have Peter Sternlight, one of his executive vice presidents, draft a letter to Solomon Incorporated stating that the firm's actions had called into question its continuing business relationship with the Fed, which was deeply troubled by the failure to make a timely disclosure of what the firm had learned. Solomon would have 10 days to report on all irregularities, violations, and oversights that it had discovered. In light of Corrigan's earlier conversation with Strauss and Gutfreund, this letter would be a death threat. If the Fed cut off Solomon's business relationship with the government, customers and lenders would desert in droves. The consequences would be huge and immediate. Solomon had the United States' second largest balance sheet, larger than Merrill Lynch, Bank of America, or American Express. Nearly all of its loans consisted of short-term debt that was callable by lenders in days or at most weeks. Only $4 billion of equity supported $146 billion of debt. Dangling off the side of the balance sheet on any given day were tens more billions, perhaps as many as $50 billion a day, of uncleared trades, transactions executed but not yet settled. These would stall midair. Solomon also had many hundreds of billions of derivative obligations not recorded anywhere on its balance sheet, interest rate swaps, foreign exchange swaps, futures contracts, a massive and intricate daisy chain of obligations with counterparties all over the world, many of whom in turn had other interrelated contracts outstanding, all part of a vast, entangled global financial web. If the funding disappeared, Solomon's assets had to be sold. But while the funding could disappear in a few days, the assets would take time to liquidate. The government had no national policy to provide loans to teetering investment banks because they were too big to fail. The firm could melt into a puddle overnight. Corrigan sat back in his chair, confident that once Solomon received Sternlight's letter, management would understand the loaded gun cocked at its head and would respond accordingly. Within Solomon, after the press release and the Wall Street Journal story, rumors were running wild. Late Monday afternoon, it held an all-hands-on-deck meeting in its huge auditorium on its lowest floor. Nearly 500 people crowded in, while hundreds, maybe more, from upstairs and from Solomon's offices around the world, watched on television screens. Gutfreund & Strauss walked the audience through a baked Alaska version of events, a crisp, well-done meringue of a surface that hid the chilly surprise. Afterward, Bill McIntosh, the head of the bond department, was summoned upstairs to Gutfreund's office, where he found Gutfreund, Strauss, and Marty Lipton, three very scared men. Earlier in the day, he had been calling for Gutfreund's head, but unexpectedly, they asked what he thought of the situation. McIntosh demanded more explanation. He felt the all-hands version and the press release had been misleading. He and Assistant General Counsel Zach Snow ended up getting drafted to write another press release. The next morning, McIntosh and Snow began drafting. Around midday, McIntosh went to tell Derek Maughan, the vice chairman of investment banking, who had just come back from running the firm's Asian operations, what was going on. Maughan knew he was hearing the harbinger of a disaster. He went to find Snow and pounced on him, saying, "You'd better be telling the whole truth to a vice chairman." But Snow had no intention of hiding anything from Maughan. He started talking, and a tale unfolded of what had transpired behind the scenes. He explained that in April, after Moser made his first confession about the February auction, Meriwether had pleaded that Moser not be fired, even though Feuerstein had said he believed Moser's actions were criminal in nature. Snow had been told, in confidence, about the situation. A month later, Moser still ran the government desk. Feuerstein was nagging Gutfreund to come clean. Gutfreund was telling him that he would. But in fact, no one had told the government. Meanwhile, Meriwether was charged with keeping an eye on Moser, who had supposedly reformed. Then Moser had asked for funding to bid on more than 100% of the 2-year note auction in late May. Even though some of the funding was supposedly to put in bids for customers, John McFarlane, Solomon's treasurer, had become alarmed. He thought it an obvious red flag and called a meeting with Snow and Meriwether. Snow had gone to Feuerstein, his boss, who agreed that it was an outrageous request. They had decided not to give Moser the funds. But Moser had secretly juggled the bids and money anyway. Managing to evade his overseers, he put in one suspicious bid and pulled off an enormous auction coup. Solomon wound up with 87% of the treasury bonds, and it and a small group of customers controlled the 2-year notes afterward. The price shot up. Others' losses from the squeeze topped $100 million, and several small firms suffered so severely that they filed for bankruptcy. Within Solomon, the squeeze had caused considerable angst. In the press, the firm was painted by its competitors as the Pirate of Wall Street. The board members, including Buffett, had expressed outrage at a meeting that Solomon had cornered the market for 2-year notes. Feuerstein had had Snow commence an internal investigation of the squeeze in June. As it turned out, Moser had held a dinner with two hedge fund customers right before the auction, and these customers had placed bids involved in the squeeze. With hindsight, the dinner pointed to possible collusion and market manipulation. But in the absence of proof, Moser explained it away. Gutfreund had set up a meeting to see his overlords at the Treasury and the Fed to mend fences over the squeeze. When he went to see Glauber in mid-June, he sat on the sofa, puffing a cigar. He offered a mea culpa to Glauber for the after-effects of the squeeze and offered to cooperate with the Treasury, but defended Moser against allegations of intentionally rigging the May auction, and he made no mention of what else he knew, leaving out anything about Moser's false bids in the earlier auction. In response to the squeeze and to the earlier run-ins with Moser, however, unbeknownst to anyone at Solomon, the SEC and the Antitrust Division of the Justice Department began investigating the firm anyway. About a week after the Glauber meeting, Gutfreund, Strauss, and Merriweather met to consider whether the firm should now come clean with the Treasury about the February auction. Because the hue and cry over the squeeze had not abated, they decided to keep silent. They felt the time was not right. Days later, the SEC sent Solomon a letter asking for information about the May auction. This was the first indication that the problem of the 2-year note auction might be escalating instead of fading away. Anyone receiving this inquiry letter might reasonably have gotten nervous about the SEC's sudden interest in the operations of the government bond trading desk. 2 days later, Gutfreund had flown to Omaha to visit Buffett while on his way to Las Vegas to see some property that Solomon had financed. In telling the backstory to Maughan, Snow, who did not know about this trip, left it out. Buffett would later fill in these details. I picked him up at the airport. John was in the office for about an hour and a half. He spent about an hour making some calls, then we talked for about half an hour. He was sort of pacing around. We didn't talk about anything in the end. It's a pain in the neck to stop in Omaha, yet he really had nothing to say. Somewhat baffled as to the purpose of the visit, Buffett took Gutfreund to a quick lunch, then for a visit to the recently acquired Borsheim's jewelry store near the Furniture Mart. The proprietor, Ike Friedman, Mrs. B's nephew, was cast in the same mold, and like her, somewhat larger than life. Friedman took Gutfreund to Borsheim's Center Island, where the really expensive goods were displayed. Gutfreund picked out a $60,000 item for Susan. It mattered to Buffett, Gutfreund said later, that he made a purchase. Then he glanced at the expensive watches strategically displayed just behind the center island and strolled over to look at the merchandise. Friedman preferred selling very expensive jewelry to timepieces. Oh, watches, he said to Gutfreund. You lose them, you break them. Why pay a lot of money for a watch? He looked at the fancy wristwatch on Gutfreund's wrist and asked Gutfreund what he paid for it. Gutfreund told him. $1,995? Friedman repeated. Well, you got taken, John. And you should have seen the look on John's face. Wearing the watch on which he got taken, Gutfreund returned to New York at the end of June to present the burgundy-colored, satin-lined Borsheim's box to Susan. Within days, by early July, the Antitrust Division of the Justice Department formally notified Solomon that it was investigating the squeeze in the May 2-year note auction, which the letter from the SEC had inquired about. Gutfreund now got serious, said Snow, and hired Marty Lipton's firm, Wachtell Lipton, Solomon's outside counsel, to begin its own investigation on behalf of Solomon of the circumstances surrounding the May squeeze. People within Solomon had mixed views about the squeeze. Some said the Treasury market was inherently designed to be collusive. The job of a dealer was to work with its customers to distribute huge blocks of bonds into the market. Little squeezes happened all the time. This one was big. So what? The Treasury was picking on Solomon. It was the years of hubris, the wildness depicted in Liar's Poker, the gradual erosion of power that had made Solomon a punching bag. But others were furious that Moser had once again defied the Treasury. They were baffled that he would pull a huge squeeze when it was well known that he and Basham were already at loggerheads. Later, these questions would increase. Why did Moser, on probation, told his behavior had been probably criminal, taunt the Treasury so outlandishly that his coup splashed headlines all over the financial press in a way guaranteed to draw even more attention to himself? Snow, who reported to Feuerstein on trading operations, had been in charge of the internal investigation involving the May squeeze. In June, he was out of the office some of the time with knee surgery, and neither he nor Feuerstein was involved in the Glauber meeting, nor knew about the subsequent decision to further delay reporting Moser's actions. But once Snow returned full-time to the office in July, increasingly he started to realize that he was out of the loop. People began disappearing into meetings. The situation preyed on his mind. One night he had a dream. He walked into Forstein's office the next morning and said he had dreamed that he and Forstein had actually called Warren Buffett and told him about the false bid because they were both so frustrated that Gutfreund and Strauss had done nothing about it. Forstein looked at Snow cross-eyed. "No, no," he said. "It won't come to that." Forstein was still trying to influence Gutfreund. Going to Buffett would be throwing that relationship away. Snow had not intended his account of the dream to come across as a subtle threat to bypass his boss and call Buffett, but he thought Forstein seemed to have taken it that way. A few days after beginning their work, the Wachtell-Lipton investigators had returned with a preliminary report on the May squeeze. Only now, however, were the investigators told that senior management had known since April that Moser had submitted an unauthorized bid in the February auction. With hindsight, Solomon's actions looked far worse. After learning of Moser's false bid in February, which Forstein had said was criminal in nature, management had taken Merriweather's vouching for Moser and Moser's word that he had never done it before without investigating further or disciplining Moser in any way. They had left him in place, which allowed the May squeeze to occur. Once it did occur, Solomon was in more trouble, because telling the government they knew about Moser's previous phony bids but had only now reported them would probably have conveyed the sense that Solomon was a gang of thieves. Worst of all, Gutfreund had met with Bob Glauber in mid-June about the May squeeze, but had said nothing about all these earlier events. Now, as Snow explained to Maughan, when things started blowing up, everyone involved started excusing the original delay by saying the matter was a single minor event that caused no customer any harm, cost the government nothing, and didn't make sense, even from the standpoint of the trader involved. Given the pressure of business, Gutfreund said, he simply hadn't deemed it that important.
Unfortunately, he was wrong about that.
The Wachtell investigators had discovered that the February auction was not the only one that Moser had rigged. They now knew that 5 auctions had been compromised. 2 of these false bids had only just been unearthed. Snow concluded by telling Maugham about the previous evening's meeting with all the inside and outside lawyers that had followed the half-baked explanation given to all employees. Snow had argued that management's prior knowledge had to be disclosed. He was batted down. "I'm going to take a lot of heat for this," Gutfreund told him. "I don't see why you can't do your part." Maughan had been deeply concerned even before hearing all this new information from Snow. 7 days had passed since the first press release, 7 days that included a salvo of stories in the media, the firm's falling stock price, trouble rolling over the commercial paper, the discovery of new false bids, and Gutfreund and Strauss feeding baked Alaska to the troops at an internal meeting. By the time Snow finished telling him all of this additional history of what Moser had done and what others had not done, Maughan blew up and started pounding Snow to make sure there was nothing else. Then he went down to the trading floor and confronted Merriweather, Moser's boss. "What the hell is going on, John?" he asked. Merriweather hung his head. "It's too late," he said. He refused to talk further. Too late or not, Snow and McIntosh had to spend the evening drafting a second press release to try to explain things. That same night, Strauss and Gutfreund called Corrigan to respond in some fashion to the Sternlight cocked gun letter, which the firm had received that morning. Realizing that he was on a speakerphone, Corrigan assumed that a room full of undisclosed lawyers was listening to everything he said. The conversation started out with Corrigan being told that the firm had done an investigation and that industry practice of other firms was to pad their bids for new issuances of municipals and agency securities to get a bigger share. Corrigan viewed this opener as a diversion or worse. It had nothing to do with the squeeze, nor with the more serious issue of phony bids. In fact, nothing to do with the treasury market. His Irish temper ignited. He yelled into the phone at Strauss and Gutfreund, "I'm sure you've got a room full of bleeping lawyers. This is your last chance. Is there anything else you have to tell me?" They began to describe the other violations. Corrigan meant to put an end to the obfuscations and rationalizations. "Well, goddammit," he said, "get yourselves together and release all of this information to the public immediately. I don't want to hear anything else from you. Just get that goddamn press release out." Late that evening, the lawyers met with senior management to go over the press release. Gutfreund and Strauss arrived. McIntosh said there needed to be heads on a plate. This idea was quickly dismissed, but other people, including a board member, Gedale Horowitz, and Steve Bell, who ran Solomon's Washington office, pressed for further disclosure. Nobody could get hold of Buffett, but they reached Munger on the phone, who said, "Look, you can't put this second press release out without names." Gutfreund's name went in automatically. Everyone knew that Strauss was not in charge and had not made any of these decisions. He had simply been present in the room. But he had gone along with his boss. His name went in. Feuerstein had tried to get Gutfreund to report it. Munger said that his name should stay out. Merriweather was known as a brilliant, careful manager who was unusually close to his team and rarely left the desk. He had reported the matter exactly as he should. On the other hand, he had vouched for Moser, pleaded his cause, then left Moser's responsibilities unchanged. "When Munger said Merriweather's name should go in," says McIntosh, "Merriweather, listening and seeing the lawyers write down his name, said, 'Oh my God, I'm doomed.'" The next day, Wednesday, August 14th, a telephone meeting took place in which the board heard some of the story that was given to Corrigan the night before. Two board members called in from Europe, one from Alaska, Buffett from Omaha, and Munger from Minnesota to hear the first orderly and halfway complete description of the Moser affair. Inside Solomon, a palace coup was well underway, with senior managers talking to one another on the assumption that Gutfreund and Strauss would have to resign. The Arbs wanted Merriweather as CEO, which was clearly unacceptable to many people given that he was Moser's boss. The Arbs then floated the idea that Derek Maughan might serve as co-CEO with Merriweather. Meanwhile, no one on the board conference call said anything about management changes. They merely debated the wording of the new press release, which contained 3 pages of details and added the 2 additional violations that had been discovered by the investigators. The draft release admitted that management had known about the February bids as far back as April, but said that the press of business kept Solomon from reporting Moser's actions to the authorities. Buffett called this ridiculous, and as the board debated, Munger became incensed. Eventually, the press release was rewritten to say that the failure occurred due to lack of sufficient attention to the matter, leaving the impression that the names in the press release were the people who were not paying attention. Arrangements were made to put out the release that night. As the meeting concluded, the board thought it had the full story. A number of things had not been mentioned, however. One was the cocked gun letter just received from Peter Sternlight at the Fed. Another was the June meeting with Bob Glauber at the Treasury Department, at which Gutfreund had failed to mention Moser's earlier activities. That afternoon, Solomon held another all-hands-on-deck meeting in the auditorium. Bill McIntosh, who ran the daily sales meeting, stood at the front as usual and had the unenviable job of reading the new press release to the employees. With Gutfreund and Strauss in the front row, directly opposite him, McIntosh said, "This is what happened. If customers call and want to know what's going on, just tell them. Make no excuses for senior management. Don't apologize for them. They did what they did." Afterward, the salespeople piled into McIntosh's office. "What are we supposed to say?" they begged. "Don't make excuses for senior management," McIntosh repeated. "In my view, they're not going to last very long. They're gone. They're yesterday's news. We've got to keep this place together so we can survive and play another day. Focus on that." That evening, the government bond department showed up on the terrace of McIntosh's duplex overlooking the Hudson River in the West Village for a previously scheduled barbecue. Eerily, Tom Strauss stopped by, and the temperature on the deck fell several degrees. Instead of hanging around until 10 or 11 swigging beer as usual, everyone cleared out by 8 o'clock. The morning after the press release appeared, Thursday, August 15th, rumors floated that the Long Knives were out and McIntosh was a goner. He stayed on the floor all day, figuring that Gutfreund and Strauss wouldn't fire him for insubordination in front of the whole trading floor. Meanwhile, market confidence in Salomon cracked. The stock, which had been sinking all week from the previous Thursday's close of almost $37, slumped to $27. It was trading down because shareholders were beginning to suspect a bigger problem than Moser's misdeeds, a run on the bank. And indeed, one was beginning to take place. The pyramided nature of the balance sheet of any investment bank was well understood by investors. Salomon was almost uniquely large, bigger than the biggest life insurer, second only to Citicorp in assets. As a major firm, Salomon's debt desk had always acted as a broker to buy and sell the firm's own medium-term notes. Suddenly, on Thursday, a long queue of sellers and no buyers appeared. In order to honor the sell orders, the traders had to buy the notes with Salomon's own cash. Since nobody else wanted to buy the notes, they now amounted to merely pieces of paper that said Salomon would pay Salomon in the future from Salomon's own vault. But as the vault emptied, the notes were going to be worthless unless something changed. To conserve cash, the traders began to deter sellers by offering a lower price. Sellers quickly figured out what was going on. The line of sellers wanting to sell notes grew longer and longer. By the end of the day, Salomon's traders had reluctantly bought $700 million of the firm's own notes. Then they put up the closed for business sign, like a depression bank snapping shut the teller's window. No other firm would buy Solly's debt either. And with that, Salomon was teetering precariously close to the edge of bankruptcy. The next morning, Friday, August 16th, the New York Times front page ran a photograph of Gutfreund with the headline, "Wall Street sees a serious threat to Salomon Brothers. Illegal bidding fallout. High-level resignations and client defections feared. Firm stock drops." The story featured prominent photographs of Gutfreund and Strauss. The two of them and Marty Lipton called Corrigan's office in New York and were patched through to Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan's office in Washington, where Corrigan and Greenspan had been on a conference call with Treasury Secretary Nick Brady since dawn, trying to figure out who the hell we're going to get to come in and run the firm. Strauss, a longtime friend, knew they were in trouble when Corrigan greeted him as Mr. Strauss. The irate Federal Reserve Bank president, assuming that the board knew about the Sternlight death threat letter, had been shocked by the latest press release they had issued. He interpreted their failure to take any action, such as firing senior management, as a sign that Salomon's board was defying him. Gutfreund said that he was going to resign. "What about Strauss?" asked Corrigan. With this, it became clear that, as far as the New York Federal Reserve was concerned, resigning was not optional. It was mandatory. Gutfreund then called Buffett. It was 6:45 a.m. Omaha time, and Buffett was still asleep when the phone rang. But he came to consciousness rapidly as Gutfreund, with Marty Lipton and Tom Strauss on the line, laid out the problem. "I just read my own obituary," Gutfreund said, referring to the New York Times. His picture on the front page had done what the sequence of events, until then, had not. A freighted pause ensued, as Buffett understood what they were really asking him. He told them that he would consider taking over the job of chairman on an interim basis, but needed to see the Times story first. He wanted a few minutes to think, but was pretty sure he needed to go to New York. He told them that he would be there as soon as he could that afternoon. Marty Lipton said that it was unthinkable for Meriwether not to be fired immediately. Buffett insisted that they do nothing until he could at least talk to Meriwether. He hung up, called Gladys Kaiser at home, and told her to cancel a lunch with the president of Grinnell. Then, he said, "Call George Gillespie in Martha's Vineyard. Cancel my trip for the weekend and put the pilot on alert that we may be going to New York." By the time he arrived less than an hour later at the office, still empty of staff, to read the obituary on the fax machine, he had made up his mind. Meanwhile, Gutfreund and Strauss had told Corrigan that Buffett was considering becoming interim chairman. "As far as I was concerned, they were both being less than candid with me," Corrigan says. "I want to talk directly to Warren Buffett immediately," he told them. I didn't know him personally, but I certainly knew his reputation. Buffett, for his part, needed to find out how Jerry Corrigan would feel if he did take the job. It took some time to track down Corrigan in Washington. He did not call Buffett back until after 8:30 a.m. Central Standard Time, after the market had opened. Salomon stock did not open for trading, which told investors that major news was pending. When Corrigan talked to Buffett, he said something about his willingness to be a little more lenient about the 10-day schedule if Buffett took the job. Though Buffett didn't grasp what Corrigan meant, he gathered that the Federal Reserve must have been asking for information about something. Corrigan sounded angry. He said that he would make no promises about anything if Buffett did take the job, and insisted that Buffett see him personally to talk about the role of interim chairman in New York that very night. At Salomon, all that the trading floor knew was that Buffett was supposedly flying in to rescue the firm and that Salomon stock was not trading. People speculated that he was considering Meriwether as a possible replacement for Gutfreund. The Arb boys were crying, "We can't lose John." J.M. himself was nowhere to be seen. The trading floor stewed and seethed, but the stock was unable to open for trading because Buffett had told them to hold the press release, which announced that Gutfreund was prepared to resign and that Buffett was temporarily taking over as chairman, until after he arrived. With the stock hanging in limbo, news stories poured out on television that itemized Salomon's problems and speculated what would come next. By early afternoon, Buffett had appeared. Once in the opulent executive suite on the 45th floor, he hit the button on the press release, and the traders opened Salomon stock. It traded furiously for the final part of the day, closing up a dollar to almost $28. After the market closed, Buffett went down to the amphitheater for a meeting with the managing directors. Gutfreund and Strauss took the stage, and Gutfreund said that they were prepared to resign. His face remained impassive, as usual. Strauss, noted Buffett, seemed shaken. Afterward, the senior management retired to the enormous conference room on the executive floor. Eric Rosenfeld and Larry Hillebrand, the key members of Meriwether's team, bullied their way into the meeting. There, next to the wall of glass overlooking the two-story football field-sized trading floor where the trouble had begun, the top brass of Salomon began to thrash out what to do next. People holding different viewpoints started kicking Meriwether around like a soccer ball. Nobody disputed that he had done the right thing by reporting Moser's actions. The debate was whether he should have done more. Some people felt, as McIntosh articulated, that he was simply too close to the flame. Meriwether had a reputation as a tight manager. In his areas, as one said, no sparrow fell that Meriwether didn't see it. Meriwether had not been involved in the false bids, but how could Salomon expect clemency while keeping him on? It seemed obvious to them that the government would treat the firm more harshly if he stayed. Although Strauss and Gutfreund were not present, they too had told Buffett that they thought Meriwether should resign along with them. With uncanny timing, Meriwether himself arrived and leaned silently against a wall, watching as most of his peers demanded his head. Buffett had told Marty Lipton earlier that day that, unlike Strauss and Gutfreund, Meriwether must not be forced to resign unless he chose to do so voluntarily. Buffett wanted time to deliberate. He did not agree with those who thought Meriwether had to go. Meriwether had not sucked his thumb. He had reported Moser to Gutfreund and Strauss. It was not so much that they thought Meriwether had done anything wrong, Buffett decided. Rather, they were panicked. Their lives were simply going to be so much easier the next morning if Meriwether was gone. The consequences of putting his name in the press release now loomed large to Buffett. After the meeting, he climbed into a waiting black town car with Gutfreund and Strauss, and they wove their way through downtown rush-hour traffic to Corrigan's office. Corrigan had felt it necessary to maintain his previous schedule in the interest of secrecy. He arrived directly from playing in the Federal Reserve's annual Officers versus Employees softball game, his tall frame clad in jeans, sneakers, and a Liberty Street Blues t-shirt. But the chill in the air was such that he could have been wearing black tie and I wouldn't have noticed, given my state of mind, Tom Strauss later said. Buffett opened disarmingly. Look, The only thing I owe personally is $70,000 on a second home I have in California because the interest rate is cheap. He promised complete cooperation with the regulators. Corrigan refused to be charmed. Interim chairmanships usually didn't work very well, he said. Buffett had better not seek help for Solomon from his Washington friends. Corrigan demanded a thorough house cleaning. Buffett agreed to all sorts of fundamental changes to strengthen Solomon's policies, controls, and documentation. His verbal commitment to me was absolute, says Corrigan, and I trusted him. Nevertheless, Corrigan made no promises. Giving Buffett a steely look, he said, "Prepare for all eventualities." It was a Dutch uncle type of talk. It was cordial enough, but the Dutch uncle aspect was there. We owed more money than virtually anybody in the country, and we owed it on very short terms. I tried once or twice to suggest how worried I was about the funding problem, hoping he might figuratively put his arm around me a little bit, but he didn't do it. Prepare for all eventualities. That was something I didn't know quite how to do. I certainly thought of strychnine or something of the sort. Then Corrigan sent Buffett out of the room so he could talk to Gutfreund and Strauss. You have a problem with an employee in your firm, he said. That's his problem. You've got a problem with an employee in your firm and you fail to do something about it? That's your problem. Then, with tears in his eyes, he told them how much he regretted ending their careers. On the way out, while Tom was in much more of a state of shock, Gutfreund again seemed quite composed. He seemed to be blaming Corrigan for forcing him to resign. I'll be damned if I'm going to grant him absolution, Gutfreund said. They rode back across downtown to Solomon, then went off to have a steak in a back room at Joe and Rose's steakhouse on 49th Street. Strauss and Gutfreund insisted again that Merriweather had to go. They talked about the candidates for chief operating officer. Close to midnight, Buffett stumbled back to Catherine Graham's apartment at the UN Plaza and tried to sleep. Later, many people wrote many things about why Buffett took the job. Some said it was his $700 million, and some said it was his duty to the other shareholders. Somebody had to take the job, he said. I was the logical person. Other than the people who were resigning, no one had more at stake. But it was not just the money. It was what he cared about just as much, his reputation. When he invested in Solomon and gave John Gutfreund his imprimatur, it was like nailing that reputation to Solomon's door like a shield. Buffett had told his children, "It takes a lifetime to build a reputation and 5 minutes to ruin it." He thought of that risk primarily in terms of his own actions, yet the people he had endorsed had put his reputation at risk. If he had made a mistake, it was to invest in Wall Street yet distance himself from it by relying on someone else. His judgment about Gutfreund's ability to oversee the runaway culture of Solomon was flawed. By this time, Buffett was the second richest man in the United States. Berkshire's per-share book value had grown by more than 23% a year for 26 years. His first group of partners had an incredible $3 million for each $1,000 they had put in. Berkshire Hathaway was trading at $8,000 per share. Buffett had a net worth of $3.8 billion. He was one of the most respected businessmen in the world.